Let us begin with prayer. Eternal God, fill us with a reverent sense of your presence, that we may be at peace and worship you now with all of our heart and mind. Amen. Many of you know that I spent almost 4 weeks this summer serving the larger church as the chaplain at Ghost Ranch, a Presbyterian camp and educational center in northern New Mexico. If you've never been to New Mexico, it's a state with a variety of different terrains that ebb and flow through and with the high desert. Ghost Ranch is about an hour north of Santa Fe and is tucked among the mesas and cliffs not far from the Chama River. 15 miles from the nearest village, Abiquiu, to the south, and 10 miles west of a tiny community at the foot of Cerro Pedernal, Yeso Canyon, where Ghost Ranch is located, was exactly what the sibling cattle rustlers known as the Archuleta brothers were looking for in terms of privacy several hundred years ago to keep their stolen cattle. Back in those days, most people avoided the Archuletas and Yeso Canyon altogether. But after a few unsuspecting travelers went missing, with the exception of their belongings that appeared among the Archuleta gang, stories began to be told about disgruntled ghosts haunting the canyon. And the canyon became known as the Ranch of the Witches. Needless to say, things didn't end well for the Archuleta brothers. They turned on each other and lived out a version of the Cain and Abel story, with one killing the other. And the ranch went uninhabited for a long period of time. Although it did retain its reputation as a haunted place, it was eventually resettled by a relative of the Archuleta brothers and then changed hands a few times, actually mostly from folks from back here in the east who found their way there. And then eventually it came to be owned by Arthur and Eleanor Pack. And they acquired the ranch and ran it for several decades, beginning in the 1920s. And it was during this time that Georgia O'Keeffe made her home in Abiquiu and had her summer cottage at Ghost Ranch. And it was from her upward gaze at the ranch that she became enamored with painting Cerro Pedernal, the flat-top mountain to the west of the ranch that you see in many of her paintings. She said that God told her in a dream that if she painted it enough, he would give it to her. The jury is still out on that, but when you stare at Pedernal today, it's hard not to think of O'Keeffe. The Packs had a vision to open the ranch to more diverse economic and social communities and began searching for an organization that would share this vision when they were getting ready to sell it in the 1950s. The Packs had conversations with the YMCA and the Boy Scouts, who had just bought a large camping facility nearby. And they had conversations with the Archdiocese of Santa Fe. But it was the surging growth of the Protestant Church in the 1950s, and especially the Presbyterians' focus on education, that captured the Pack's imagination and the imagination of the leadership at the Board of Christian Education of the Presbyterian Church, of which our own Mark Hostetter's grandfather was part of at the time and was in the original group of people who went when the ranch was purchased from the Packs. The rest, as they say, is history. But it's fair to say that the history of Ghost Ranch, like the history of our own church, is still unfolding. And so today I want to share with you some of my experiences from my time at the ranch this summer, some stories I shared with the people that I met there, and some stories that I think share across the miles from New Mexico back here to New York City. While I was at Ghost Ranch, I found myself gravitating to the resurrection stories that I love so much. For me, these are the campfire stories of the Gospels. We heard Diana and Bob read two of them here this morning. My second night at the ranch, it started to rain lightly, and we were treated to a beautiful, full, double rainbow over Kitchen Mesa. It was stunning. And I spent a good half an hour just staring up at the heavens. And I was thinking about that experience. It got me to wondering about the disciples and what they were staring into the heavens at in Acts. Diana read for us this morning. I started to ask myself that question, why am I standing here staring up at the heavens? It was pretty obvious, I guess, surrounded by all the beauty of that place, but that particular experience of gazing up at the heavens at that rainbow made me think differently about the awe the disciples must have felt watching Jesus ascend into heaven. I guess I've always assumed in hearing that story in the past that the disciples were too afraid to do anything else. At Ghost Ranch, it felt as if this question shifted. And instead of asking, as I usually do, how it might inspire me to get moving again, this question suddenly had a lot of power in its face value. Why was I standing there staring up at the heavens? What was I doing? We ask all these sorts of questions from time to time, and we all experience different answers depending on what part of the heavens we might be gazing at in any given moment. But whether you're among the mesas of the Western landscape or in the streets of New York City, the question is an important one. We all come to this place right now for a reason. We may be grieving or seeking some form of mental or spiritual peace. We may be wanting to be with friends or connect with family history in some way. And imagine, if you will, the diverse tapestry of answers that the disciples would have given to that question if it was recorded in Acts. Some of them would have said they were looking up at the heavens because it was beautiful to see the sky where Jesus went. Some of them would have said that they were staring up at the heavens because they missed him. Others would have said that they were gazing at the sky because they didn't want that moment to end. There are moments for all of us disciples where we need to stare up at the heavens. We need to feel the immense grandeur of God's creation around and among us. We need to pray the prayers that come to our lips when we're lying on our backs and looking up at the stars. These experiences lead each of us to be able to answer for ourselves what we're doing, gazing up at the heavens. They become part of the story we tell as we sit around the campfire and build community together. The resurrection stories seem like campfire stories to me because they capture so well the power of nostalgia of these moments among the disciples. And I use that word nostalgic carefully here because I don't always think it carries a positive connotation. But in this case, I mean it very much that way. The definition itself suggests an experience that's fraught with emotion. It is literally to be excessively sentimental. Being nostalgic implies a yearning. The resurrection stories embody this feeling. And I'm not talking about the details right at the tomb on that first Easter morning. I mean these sleepy Sunday afternoon stories. Like the one Bob read for us today, the stories that get even harder to believe. The road to Emmaus, where the disciples don't even know they're walking with Jesus, and then he disappears from in front of them. Jesus appearing behind the locked doors in Jerusalem, without Thomas and then with him. Jesus preparing breakfast on the beach for his disciples. I love these stories. These stories that the disciples share about the power of memory tell us a lot about where we sit right now on this summer Sunday in August, when the lazy summer nights captivate our minds, and we can just be with our yearning and not jump to do the next thing on our list. I think a lot of the stories that we share as a congregation would be resurrection stories. Certainly the stories I heard from folks that I met out at Ghost Ranch would fit well into that category. Our memories, our articulation of what in the world to do next in our discipleship. Those are the campfire stories of the resurrection. I was also struck this summer by reading one of Marilynne Robinson's early novels called Housekeeping. Some of you have probably read it. She sums up near the end of that book the power of storytelling and memory in relation to our Christian story in these words. Memory is a sense of loss, she says, and loss pulls us after it. God himself was pulled after us into the vortex we made when we fell, or so the story goes. When he was on earth, he mended families. He gave Lazarus back to his mother, and to the centurion, he gave his daughter again. He even restored the severed ear of the soldier who came to arrest him, a fact that allows us to hope that the resurrection will reflect a considerable attention to detail. Yet this was no more than tinkering. Being man, he felt the pull of death, and being God, he must have wondered more than we do what it would be like. He is known to have walked on water, but he was not born to drown. And when he did die, it was sad. Such a young man, so full of promise. And his mother wept, and his friends could not believe the loss. And the story spread everywhere. And the mourning would not be comforted until he was so sharply lacked and so powerfully remembered that his friends felt him beside them as they walked along the road and saw someone cooking fish on the shore and knew it to be him. And they sat down to supper with him, all wounded as he was. There is so little to remember of anyone, an anecdote, a conversation at the table. But every memory is turned over and over again. Every word, however chance, written in the heart in the hope that memory will fulfill itself and become flesh, and that the wanderers will find a way home, and the perished, whose lack we always feel, will step through the door finally and stroke our hair with dreaming and a habitual fondness, not having meant to keep us waiting so long. When we find those things that nourish us, that comfort us, we return to them. This table, this place, the memories of those gone before us to God's arms and those still living among us, standing with the oppressed, lifting up those who are in despair. I love how Marilynne Robinson puts it. He was so sharply lacked and so powerfully remembered. that his friends felt him beside them. That's part of what I love about these resurrection stories and what I love about the community we share and the stories around the campfire. It's that collision of what we know we lack and what we remember. Because I don't know about you, but I feel that lack, that twinge of something missing pretty acutely at times. But I don't always bring that power of remembering into the equation. Maybe I'm afraid to feel what that's like, even though that's what I need. Maybe you've felt that way yourself. But it's no accident that Jesus doesn't leave the disciples or us alone in these moments. In fact, that's exactly when he appears. Helps out with the fishing, shares a meal, invites us all to breakfast around the campfire. So when we share these stories together around the campfire, around the communion table, around a cup of coffee, when we dare to remember together and name what we lack and what we long for, we feel Christ with us. And every time we do that together, we open ourselves a little more to admitting where our sharp lack and our powerful remembering collide. We walk right onto that beach with him, right into the sanctuary of this church, right between the mesas at Ghost Ranch, and settle down by the campfire. And we feel God's presence with us, and we know that we're home, with God tousling our hair.